Ukrainians. Identity and Dignity podcast is on the air. Within the last few days, the world has unveiled Ukrainians as a nation of courageous and indomitable people who relentlessly struggle for their freedom. We showed our enemy what they should expect if they jeopardize our dignity, a core value of Ukrainians. A lot of people worldwide now follow the news from Ukrainian hotspots, but we believe that without understanding our identity and the circumstances that formed us, the world won't be able to understand us enough, which will limit the prospects of support and cooperation. So, what makes us who we are? What is the bottom line of the Ukrainian people's dignity? In this podcast, we will tell you about the milestones which form our identity and make us a part of the European community. Today we are going to recite a story of Donbas. How did it pave the way to its cultural authenticity and Ukrainian image? And how Russia attempted to erase this sense of authenticity? We'll also cover the modern region of Donbas with its quirks and assortment of political ideas. To grasp the modern story of Donbas, we should plunge into the past and see the palette of metamorphose of this region. How did it evolve into a pearl of the industrialism? Why did Donbas become a weak spot for Russian expansion? We pondered on it and now invite you to read the story to complete a puzzle together. Donbas is known as a prominent industrial region, but this page of history is not a long-lasting part of it. What did Donbas look like a bit more than 100 years ago, before the Industrial Revolution? Ukrainian ethnologist Lesya Hasidzhak explains it.
Donbas is truly a Ukrainian region. Right to the 15th century, it was a wild field. A territory crossed by many who dropped by this land or lived there. The era of the 15th-18th centuries is depicted with Cossack settlement and colonization incited by the Russian Empire. Sure, Donbas was also home to some peasants, refugees who searched for space for life. It lasted until the 19th century.
Indeed, Donbas is a part of wild field. Wildfield, steppe territory of southeastern Ukraine that wasn't inhabited until the 15th century. To oppose the enemies, Cossacks established their self-organized militarized republics. The core aim of Cossacks was to live free and quench the oppression of those who wanted to encroach on their land and freedom. Polish Moscovian Tatars. Note that in that time Ukraine land split into two vast sides, one controlled by the Tsardom of Russia and the other by Rzecz Pospolita, Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Hence, the uncivilized wildfield became a settlement for defense and breath of freedom. The history of the modern Donbas begins in the 19th century. The sources of various metals and coal were found there and made Donbas the industrial heart of the empire. British, French, and Belgian companies invested in the prolific region. One of the cities created by foreigners was Yuzivka, owing to its fame to the British investor John Hughes, who organized his factory nearby. The town reflected a European tendency architecturally and culturally. As the country experienced industrialization, the enriched land demanded many extra hands. That's why numerous peasants from Russian-deprived provinces started to settle within Donbas in search of better life. They were poor and thus intensely inhabited the region that could feed them. Conversely, the average 19th century Ukrainians had more land plots than Russians and weren't that heavily indebted. So they didn't need to concentrate in the region. The Russification of the region in the times of Russian Empire was manifested through cancelling Ukrainian skeleton, its language, its culture. In 1863, Russia launched the so-called Valuyev Circular that banned publications linked to religion, education, and literature made in Ukrainian. A few years later, in 1873, Ukraine went through another backstabbing, Emsk Ukaz. The document initiated another ban policy on Ukrainian tongue to completely eradicate it from people's eyes. the move was implemented to crack down on allegedly pro-separatist sentiments of Ukrainians. So with Russian resettlement within Donbas and denationalizing policies of the empire, the bridge to Russification of the region was paved. After Soviet totalitarian regime came, life got way tougher for ordinary people. In the times of Holodomor, the condition has deteriorated to the critical level. One fourth of Donbas was eradicated, a huge loss for the region's authenticity. In 1933, many families from Belarus, Russia, and north of Ukraine were resettled to the territory. In total, 21,000 people. Then, after the bloody page of World War II, when land needed to be rebuilt, a new wave of people saturated Donbas. From 400 to 700,000 people annually moved to the region, creating a societal mix. Under the pressure of ideological policies, the new society got too fragile to oppose Russification. There is no more ethnic exclusivity Donbas was prone to previously. Moreover, the census of 2001 argues 133 out of 134 ethnic groups, natives of Ukraine, are represented in Donbas. Educational system also was the marker of how Soviet machine worked on cultural assimilation. Here is why. Stats from the Ministry of Education of the Ukrainian Soviet Republic on the ratio of Russian to Ukrainian students in 1958-1959 tells us. In Donetsk, nearly 900 students studied in Ukrainian schools, which was only 1.2% of students, whereas the rate of those who attended Russian-speaking schools was 98.8%, equivalent to 76.3 thousand people. Vasil Stus, Ukrainian dissident, poet, and human rights activist, who worked in Donbas as a teacher of Ukrainian language and literature, described his feelings in a piece of letter in 1962.
In Donbas, and not only, teaching Ukrainian in a Russian school is nothing but an academic and cultural obstacle. To do so is to endure great moral trauma. One oral statement from the parents suffices. With this in mind, their children will not learn the language of the people who raised these same parents. Isn't this a Hopak-like theater with vodka and shorovari? Everyone sure learns German, French, and English, though not their native tongue.
Higher education in the region was conducted entirely in Russian, except for the departments of Ukrainian philology. However, the demand for such faculties was beyond the lowest scale. Oleksa Tihy, Ukrainian philosopher and flaming human rights activist, also reflects on the poignant state of Donbas, his homeland.
It's not guilt, but a disaster of the ordinary people, hardworking laborers and villagers, that Ukrainian language and culture fall through their own will and tacit consent. It's not a disaster, but the guilt of the intelligence, the educated people who hold some key positions, but their desire is confined only to filling up their bellies. They are simply past caring about the destiny of the people, their culture and language. Shouldn't we deem the work of the education authorities, teachers, or cultural figures as the assimilation of millions of Ukrainians in Donbas? This tremendous assimilation is nothing but an intellectual genocide.
Then 90s. So far as Donbas mainly was an industrial region, it suffered a crumbling economic ruin after the Soviet Union's collapse. The region has a high level of urbanization and industrial involvement. So the economic crisis has turned into a social catastrophe during the first years of the independence of Ukraine. The crisis devastated entire cities and wiped out enterprises with thousands of employees. The miners didn't receive salaries for 10-15 months. Many were simply kicked out on the streets. In some mining villages, illegal activities were the only alternative to starvation. People stole metal from dead industrial facilities, illegally collected coal, and dug the illicit private mines. The eyewitness says,
"The official program of the state was to shut down unprofitable mines. They closed them, but they did not think what to do with the people, with the miners. From here began the era of the so-called kopanky or holes."
In one of those illegal artisanal mines worked a 15-year-old Yuri, a character of the documentary The Mine No. 8. He was making a living for his two sisters and himself. A 15-year-old Yuri says,
"There were times when we made good money. It is now that there is no work. Then I spent my money on my sisters and myself. Mom and dad drank a lot, and there was nothing else to do but to act."
Economic and social degradation in Donbas sparked a criminal war. Violent showdowns and guns in the glove compartments of cars prevailed over law and diplomacy. The criminal war, which has lasted in Donbas for more than 5 years, over the redistribution of its production potential has not ended in favor of local workers. It ended with the establishment of the corrupt structures, organized criminal clans. They concentrated in their hands all the political power and economic resources of the region. Instead, common people were barred from making any important decisions. The chief of the police in Slovyansk describes the situation.
"In every day, in every district, there were these formations, but starting somewhere in the 90s, the centralization of these formations began. That is, those people who on the periphery did not obey the central bandit power, they as a rule were punished or killed. It was according to thieves' concepts."
Since the 2000s, a businessman from the clan has become a new hero of Donetsk identity and political life. A typical example is Viktor Yanukovych. The result of the formation of regional elites was the entry of the new powerful player, the Party of the Regions, which has been significantly strengthened by the financial support of the local lobby. They believe among the population of Donbas that only regional elites in the face of businessmen can represent their interests popularized the political forces from the criminal clans. It in turn caused the electoral polarization of Ukraine. The most polarized was the 2004 presidential election. Pro-Russian Viktor Yanukovych was mainly supported in the regions of eastern and southern Ukraine, while pro-European Viktor Yushchenko had overwhelming support in the west of Ukraine and its central part. However, the issue of pro-Russian political support in the east of Ukraine is far more complicated than just the territorial affiliation of the electorate. Donetsk and Luhansk repeatedly threatened to separate from Kyiv, but it was no serious declarations, but political games of the local elite. The regional authorities usually manipulated to get more subsidies from the Ukrainian budget. Yet, Donetsk and Luhansk were the largest recipients of the state budget. However, the Donbas clans got the main profit from this portion of money, not the millions of local residents. Russia used the appetite of local elites for geopolitical sabotage. The influence of the Russian lobby in Donbas was directly proportional to Russia's investment in local economy and the level of dependence on Russian market. But Russian impact is also about continuous cultural expansion and ideological intervention towards Donbas. Russia invested millions in the propaganda that shaped the worldview of local residents of Donbas. The aim was to spread the so-called Russian world. Russian geopolitical and ideological doctrine and the idea of Russian Donbas. For instance, the Russian oligarch Konstantin Malafeyev, devotee of the Russian world, sponsored brainwashing on mass media and supported illegal military formations in Donbas. Russian propaganda also roused Donbas against the rest of Ukraine. In publications published in 2016 in the newspaper Donetsk Reach, Galicia was called the base of fascism in Ukraine, and the unity of the state was destroyed by fascist ideology. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Isn't it the ideas of Putinism so widespread during the full-scale war in Ukraine started by Russia? And Russia's mission remains the same. We are here to rescue all, previously Donbas, now the entire Ukraine. The allegation of the age-old Russianness of the east of Ukraine is a Moscow falsification. Russia orchestrated pro-Kremlin and separatist uprisings in Ukrainian cities of the east, including Donbas. An American historian, Hiroyuki Kurumiya, who majors in the Soviet and modern Ukrainian history, visited Donbas in the 90s and claims,
"I must admit, life in Donbas was very difficult then. Its inhabitants didn't feel very happy. The miners staged strikes, but I didn't hear any militancy in human voices. Yes, they were annoyed, but in this sense, the rest of Ukraine could say that it would be angry with Kyiv. I didn't come across any separatist sentiments. This myth was created later due to the influence of Russia."
The hybrid Russian war gradually moving to its peak, and then in 2014 it hit Donbas, a fragile spot of Ukraine. Though the preparation on the seizure of territory was thorough and has its roots in a remote 2005. The first materials on the campaign appeared to create the Donetsk Republic in 2005. In those materials was active pro-Russian propaganda that was directed against democratic and European way, which was chosen by Ukrainian power and people in 2004, reflecting the victory of the Orange Revolution. Diana Ducik, the media expert, writes on those campaign materials.
"Those materials told that the impure evil, Orange Black, took over our land under the slogans of democracy and came from the West to destroy our life. The postcards called upon to continue to fight for our holy Donetsk Rus."
And in December, the campaign worked out well. The public organization Donetsk Republic was founded. Within a month, Donetsk City Council legalized this organization, whose strategic aim was to build the Federal Republic of Ukraine. It suggested that every federation in Ukraine would have its own autonomic rights, with the key one concentrated in the east of the country. The work of the so-called republic was prolific. It received permission to collect signatures about holding a referendum on the independence of Donbas. After that, the illegal organization began to collect signatures for leaving Ukraine and merging into one state entity consisting of Donetsk, Dnipropetrovsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia republics. The debate was continuously heated by Russian-backed devotees of the Russian world. But in 2007, Viktor Yushchenko, the then president of Ukraine, banned and condemned the activities of the public organization Donetsk Republic. Though the fight wasn't sufficient, the organization continued its illegal work behind enemy lines. Nevertheless, the only period of sincere and mass separatism in Donbas was in the late 1980s, when Donbas, along with all Ukraine, sought to separate from the USSR. In 1991, on the nationwide referendum, the population of Donbas chose to be a part of Ukraine. According to the results of the referendum, 84% of the population of the Donetsk region and 84% of the Luhansk region voted for the independence of Ukraine. However, the most convincing stat was collected just before the Russian invasion in 2014. Here is the thought of Volodymyr Panyoto, Ukrainian sociologist who explains the sentiments of Donbas in 2014.
"We conducted a research in Donbas in May 2014. Then, in Luhansk and Donetsk regions, 30% of the population wanted to unite with Russia. But those 30% received well-prepared leaders, weapons, and everything was prearranged for them."
So even in this context, the pro-Russian rebels were the absolute minority. The Donbas falls within Ukrainian values, though some caveats, neatly prepared by Russia, inflamed the sense of national identity of the people native to the region. It is not a coincidence. As Orwell puts it, who controls the past controls the future. Russia did want to engrave Russianness artificially and did it in the past. Now the history repeats itself, and once again Russia encouraged the Russian world in Donbas. But will it work out as the desirable scenario for Moscow? We are going to cover the forthcoming events and fate of Donbas in our next episode. Glory to Ukraine!